Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present my work, despite the fact that I could not come in person. So today my talk will be about wormholes, not Euclidean wormholes, but actual science fiction wormholes. So one such drawing of a wormhole is on my slide. It's by John Wheeler. So it's a wormhole handle connecting to space regions. So let me start from the gravitational motivation of my talk. So we know many such static solutions of traversable wormholes, but an interesting question is how can we form such objects dynamically? And in general, such process may involve topology change because there will be new space-time regions connecting different regions. And so quantum information perspective should be very useful because such process would go beyond semi-classic Einstein gravity. The problem is much easier if we already have connected space and we just want to stabilize the wormhole handle. So for example, if we have two entangled black holes. And there are known protocols for this, namely Gao, Jeffrey, Swole, and Kitaev, Yoshida. So if you don't know what these are, please don't leave my presentation because I will explain them in a few slides. And in fact, Kitaev-Yoshida protocol involves measurement with post-selection. So the second part of my motivation is purely a quantum information one. So recently there has been a lot of discussions of measurement-induced phase transitions in condensed matter community. And the upshot is that quantum systems are often resilient to measurements. So one needs a finite measurement rate for something interesting to happen. And there are some lessons from this phenomena. For example, MIPT and entanglement can be very beautifully explained by emergent quantum error correction of random quantum circuits. And so the questions we can ask is there anything we can learn from such dynamics about QFTs and holographic QFTs? And how do we even describe measurements in QFT? Because measurement is something very UV sensitive. And another question is, can we perhaps understand wormhole formation as a certain MIPT? Today, I would like to partially answer these questions. So first of all, I will explain that measurements are often equivalent to Euclidean evolution, and Euclidean evolution can be performed in QFT. There is no problem with that. So this is one point. And the second point is that there is indeed a phase transition in Gao, Jeffrey, Swole, and Kitaev-Yoshida protocols. So from the bulk perspective, it's a transition from two entangled black holes to an eternal traversable wormhole. And from the boundary perspective, it's a measurement-induced phase transition in quantum teleportation. So quantum teleportation is the boundary dual of traversing a wormhole. So, and strictly speaking, this result holds in SYK/JT gravity, which is the model we analyzed. So the plan for today is this. First, I will describe wormholes, traversable wormholes, and Gao, Jeffrey, Swole protocol, and argue that there is indeed a phase transition there, it's strong coupling. This would be almost MIPT because the evolution is actually unitary. But then I will graduate to an actual evolution with measurements, which is the Kitaev-Yoshida protocol. And I will explain my statement that measurements are equivalent to Euclidean evolution. And then I will use these techniques to actually study the Kitaev-Yoshida protocol at high rate and show that there is indeed a phase transition. So let me start from very familiar picture. So I have Einstein-Rosen bridge. So I have two distinct universes. Each of them contain a black hole. And these black holes, they share interior. So at the bottom, you see Penrose diagram. And Einstein-Rosen bridge at each point in time, it's perfectly smooth. And the problem why it's not traversable is because it grows too fast. So it grows with the speed of light. So an inertial observer cannot really cross it. And eventually they will fall into the singularity. And a boundary way to probe the expanding length of the Einstein-Rosen bridge is to study the equal time correlation function. So in my talk, I will follow SVK convention, sometimes denote time by U. So U is the boundary time. And if I consider left-right equal time correlation function, then it decays exponentially. And this exponential decay is directly related to this growth of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So from the boundary perspective, what happens is that I have a two-sided system, left and right, and they are initially entangled, but otherwise they're not interacting. So they both evolve according to their own Hamiltonian. And so there is no causal connection between the two. So if we consider fermionic operators on left and right, then their anticommutator is identically zero. And so from the boundary perspective, what I want to do is I want to perform some kind of teleportation protocol where I use the existing entanglement to actually send some information from left to right. And the most simple way to probe for that is to study this anti-commutator of left-right operators. So one of such protocols was studied in the beautiful paper by Gao, Jeffrey, Swall, where they introduced a coupling between left and right systems. So the coupling strength is denoted by mu. And they showed that in the bulk, this coupling introduces negative energy and it slows down the expansion of the Einstein-Rosen bridge and makes it traversable for a limited amount of time. So they performed their analysis perturbative in the coupling mu, but I would like to ask what happens if mu is large. So as you see, for now, the evolution is unitary. So what you need to know about SYK and JT is that at low energies, at large n, the theory is described by an effective Hamiltonian of one just bosonic degree of freedom L. And this L is exactly the length of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So initially I have a particle moving in the exponential potential and L just grows to infinity. However, if I introduce the left-right coupling, there is now an attraction term which actually creates a local minima of this potential. And so now there is a solution where L is just constant and the Einstein-Rosen bridge is not expanding. And this is known as Moldacena-Shi solution. But I want to ask a different question. I want to ask this. Suppose I have some initial black hole configuration where I don't have the coupling mu. And then at some point in time, I just switch it on. And really, this is now just a high school physics problem because I have some initial particle motion and a potential, and then I suddenly change the potential and I ask what happens. So I leave it as an exercise to you to show that there is indeed a phase transition and you can easily derive what's the critical value of mu and so on. So let me illustrate the different phases. So if mu is zero, I have JT gravity, which is just a rigid ADS2 space-time. So this is the global ADS2. Time runs upwards. So I have a left boundary and right boundary. They're described by semicircles. And in this picture, the Einstein, the non-traversability of the Einstein-Rosen bridge can be easily seen. So if I send a signal from the left, it can never reach the right boundary. So this blue signal, it just completely misses. So now if mu is small, then at some point when I switch it on, the expansion of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is the distance between these gray boundaries, so the expansion slows down a little bit, but then the wormhole is traversable only for a limited amount of time, because afterwards it will still continue growing. So this is the Gao-Jeffreys-Wall computation. But in JT, you can study the large values of mu as well. And then what happens is that above some critical value, which depends on the parameters of your theory and the initial temperature and when exactly you switched on the interaction. So above this critical value, the wormhole length, it just stops growing. There might be some residual oscillations, but it never grows to infinity. So the wormhole becomes eternally traversable. Let me make a few comments. So such behavior was actually conjectured for near extremal rotating BTZ black hole based on perturbation theory. So it was done in the paper by Brianna and Don. But simplicity of JT allowed us to find the full solution. And the interpretation is this. So Gao-Jeffreys-Wall is capable of introducing negative energy into the bulk. And so potentially we might introduce too much negative energy. And if the black hole is charged, then there is a possibility that we might make it super extremal. And so then the question is, what happens? Do we get a naked singularity? And the answer is no, we don't get a naked singularity. We get an eternal traversable wormhole instead. And we also analyze such setup when the initial Einstein-Rosen bridge contained extra matter excitations. And then there is a phase transition in this case as well. So it doesn't have to be an empty TFD for this to happen. So let me now discuss Kitaev-Yoshida protocol, which might be less familiar to people here. It looks very similar to Gao-Jeffreys-Wall. I again add the interaction between left and right, but now this interaction is not of Hamiltonian type. What happens is that at each time step, I pick up a subsystem from left and right, and I project these subsystems on the maximally entangled state. And then I feed them back into the systems. So this triangle Bell, it means the projection on the maximally entangled state or Bell state. And so the question I would like to ask is what happens if I do this frequently? So in previously, Kitaev-Yoshida studied what happens if I introduce one big projection, but I want to do this continuously at high rate. So how do I describe this protocol mathematically? So every time step du with this probability, I just leave the system alone and I don't do anything. So this defines this measurement rate kappa. Otherwise, I pick a random subsystem on each side and I project them on the Bell state. And what does projection mean? It means that I perform a certain measurement, and if I don't like the outcome, I throw away that sample and I start from the scratch. So if you think about qubits, then you can easily convince yourself that in Bell state, certain spin operator has a definite eigenvalue. And so I want to measure that spin operator, and I want this specific eigenvalue to be, say, plus one. If I get minus one, I throw away that sample. This is a physical operation. It requires a lot of overhead because you are literally throwing away samples. But even now, people perform that on existing quantum devices. And so this is a completely legit operation. The only problem with this is that the trace is not preserved. So we need to describe such evolution using a non-normalized density matrix rho tilde. And it undergoes the following evolution. So with this probability, nothing happens to the system. And with probability kappa, I perform the projection. So psi left and psi right, left and right, SYK fermions. And this is the Hermitian operator I want to measure. And then I evaluate my observables by normalizing by the amount of samples I have left. So the problem with this protocol is that it's very violent. So in QFT, the projection simply wouldn't exist. And in SYK, we don't want to raise the energy too much unless we want to lose the bulk dual. So we don't really want to do this. Measurement is really violent. What we can do instead is to study so-called weak measurements. And it's basically we couple the system to an Ancilla qubits, and then we measure the Ancillas instead. And this way we really don't do anything bad to our system. So how does it work mathematically? So suppose I have my system in the state rho, and I couple it to an Ancilla in state zero. So suppose Ancilla is just a qubit with two states, zero and one. Then they together undergo certain evolution. So with this evolution operator U, and so this is the most generic outcome I can have. And when what I do next is that I measure the Ancilla, and I only keep the outcome when I measured it in the state zero. So now the state of the system is this. And this U00 is a sublock of a unitary matrix. And the sublock of a unitary matrix, it doesn't have to be unitary. For example, it can have a form of Euclidean evolution. So where S is some spin operator. And in our paper, indeed, we found such operator U, which sublock is just E to the spin operator. So you can find all other blocks just from the unitarity of the whole matrix U. So this is the statement I promised you in the beginning, that measurements are often equivalent to Euclidean evolution. In the most generic case, you can require that U00 dagger is equal to itself, and then you take the logarithm of that thing, and it gives you the Euclidean evolution operator. And so the final evolution equation looks like this. So it introduced this anti-commutator term in the evolution. So it is not a Hamiltonian evolution. S is the spin operator in a SVK model. And this is a perfectly nice evolution equation. It preserves hermicity and complete positivity. And in fact, similar coupling was analyzed some time ago by Brian Swingle and collaborators. And if we compare this to the Gao-Jeffries-Wall case, we see that it looks very similar. It just instead of the commutator, the Hamiltonian type, we have anti-commutator. And we can analyze this evolution in a simple way using Schwinger-Keldysh technique. So what is that? So suppose I have a normal unitary evolution of my density matrix, then I have to dress it on both sides by either evolution operator. And as you know, each of them can be represented as Feynman path integral. And this is the origin of the doubling the number of degrees of freedom in the Schwingel-Keldysh formalism, because now I have path integral for plus part and I have a path integral for minus part. But in our case, we have this extra Euclidean evolution. And so when I try to interpret such kind of evolution using the Hamiltonian, then my effective Hamiltonians, they will be non-Hermitian. But on plus part and minus part, they are complex conjugates, so this is why they preserve the Hermiticity. At the end. And this operator S is the same operator as in Gauss-Jeffrey-Swall protocol. So now I can analyze again the system at low energies. And so I have these two very simple effective Hamiltonians where now this interaction strength is complex. So these 2 degrees of freedom L, they are now allowed to be complex. But when I actually perform measurement of my observables, then the Schwingel-Keldysh always comes with the boundary condition that plus equals to minus. So this is because I evaluate trace. And so the actual observables are, of course, real. And one can study the motion of such in such complex potential numerically. It's pretty easy. And then for large delta, so maybe I should have mentioned before that delta is the conformal dimension of the interaction of SYK fermions. So for delta more than 1/2, nothing interesting happens. But for delta less than 1/2, there is a complex trajectory which spends a lot of time near the critical point of this complex Hamiltonian. So it spends a lot of time there. And we also verified that such behavior is robust towards robust against perturbations. So this red dot is this critical point, and you can see at late time the trajectory spent a lot of time there. And because of that, the wormhole length actually stops growing. So in this picture, you see the wormhole length for different temperatures. So at high temperatures, when the coupling is weak, this extra Euclidean evolution does not do anything. The Einstein-Rosen bridge still grows linearly with time. But at lower temperatures, when the effective coupling kappa is effectively large, I see that I go into a steady state, which does not depend on the initial temperature and where Einstein-Rosen bridge has finite length. And we also looked at the actual anti-commutator between left and right, and we showed that it's large. So what are the takeaways from my talk? So Euclidean evolution can be recast as measurement with post-selection, and this is a perfectly nice evolution. It's accessible in labs even now. And it's really easy to form an eternal traversable wormhole if you already have EFD state. Just pick up your favorite teleportation protocol like Gauss-Jeffrey-Swall or Kitaev-Yoshida and crank up the coupling. I probably don't have much time left, but let me briefly say that there is an interesting question. What happens if the black holes were initially unentangled and we couple them? So I have 2 completely independent black holes and I add an interaction between them. So in SYK, this can actually be analyzed using the a boundary description, and the transition to internal wormhole indeed happens, but this seems to rely on SVK macroscopic details. So yeah, these are the open questions that I have. I will come to that slide in a minute. So I started my presentation with the drawing by John Wheeler, so inspired by Brian Swingle style of presentations. Let me end with the illustration by AI. So this is traversable wormhole supported by measurements drawn by Midjourney. Okay, thank you. I will take questions now.
Hi, I was just wondering, so it seems like in higher dimensions, the construction of traversable wormholes is somehow more challenging, but does your perspective, is there anything you could say based on your perspective?
Yes, it's more challenging, but there are some static solutions which are stable and they don't require any exotic matter. For example, a few years ago, we had a paper with Juan Maldacen and Fyodor Popov on the traversable wormhole supported by Casimir energy. So again, this is a static solution, but it's not clear, you know, how one can obtain this such solution dynamically if I start from two unentangled black holes. If the black holes are entangled, then yeah, it would be interesting to recycle our results in JT and see how this transition from TFD to an internal wormhole happens, say, in higher dimensions. It's an interesting question.
Thanks.
Okay, I believe we have some virtual question.
No.
No? Oh, that's actually your question.
I just have a couple questions. Somebody did have the, yeah, there might be a virtual question, but let me first ask. I'm intrigued by this statement that you can get Euclidean evolution in the lab with measurement and post-selection, and you actually cited, I think, some experimental work. So I'm just curious what thing they were doing.
I think they were simulating one of these. They were trying to see experimentally one of these measurement-induced phase transitions. So they never rephrased it as a Euclidean evolution. What they do in the lab, they just measure spin operators. So they measure spin and then they post select on the particular outcome. And all I wanted to say is that such evolution is can be seen as a Euclidean evolution.
I see. And can this method be used to prepare the thermal field double state, which after all can be written as Euclidean evolution?
It's a very interesting question. Yeah, I think in this case your measurement might be sort of complicated. So here, basically, what I shown is that the Euclidean evolution with the spin operator can be obtained by coupling a system to just two state. Auxiliary system. If your evolution operator is more complicated, then your ancilla and the interaction might be more complicated as well. But it's an interesting question.
Can I ask one more question from an online person?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Padegmos Lehi asks, can we work on other forms of the black holes instead of Einstein-Rosenbridge? For example, Morris-Thorne white hole.
Well, as long as I'm not sure what kind of wormhole is meant, but well, if it has a boundary description, then sure.
Actually, I think the question is wormhole, not white hole.
Sorry. Yes, but I mean the answer is the same. Yeah, if it has a boundary description, then sure.
Thanks.
All right, very good. Then let's thank our holographically projected speaker again.